Welcome to this 230th episode of Europe Calling. We'll speak mostly English today. So, if you listen to me and understand me well, that's not a problem for you. But should we at some point have a German question or switch quickly into German, you'll find interpretation under the control panel on the little globe. And from here, I will try to speak English and start with a couple of service announcements. So, at Europe Calling, you can ask your questions and upvote those of others. We use an app called Slido for that, and you will see the link in the chat in a minute. And please ask your questions there and rate those of the others, because we have 2,500 registrations. That's the only way we can figure out what question interests you most if you vote it up. That's impossible for us to do otherwise. And please, if you ask a question, mention a name or include a name. Otherwise, I have to come up with one because I don't like to say anonymous user, because now I said it right and I will probably say it wrong a few times. So, and as always, Europe Calling will be recorded and we are already live on YouTube and available as a podcast. And please keep this in mind when asking questions. So that's all for service announcements. Let's start. When I reached out to our three guests you see here last week, the feeling was what's happening in Los Angeles? It's big. Maybe it's a new phase in the resistance against Trumpism. And I mean, a lot has changed since last week and moved. So it's really impossible to basically plan anything at the moment right now. And at the same time, back last week, we were also thinking what we have discussed at Europe Calling many times, that the global alt-right, the Trumpists, the fascists, they're extremely well connected. And they're supporting each other financially, strategically, personally, all over the globe. And if those fascists, they are actually global, the resistance against them should be global as well. And that's why, we need to connect, and we believe that, we need to be global, we need to support each other, and we need to learn from each other, from strategies, from successes, and from failures. And that is why I invited these three guests here: Nora Benavides, Marcy Shore, and Jakub Majmurek. And in the first half of the webinar, you will hear their views and comments. And in the second half, we'll open for questions and discussion. And without further ado, we'll start with Nora Benavides. She's a civil rights lawyer and free speech lawyer in Los Angeles. She's the director of digital justice and civil rights at the think tank Free Press, with a background in fighting disinformation, surveillance, and threats to democratic engagement. And she is and has been closely involved in the current protests in LA. And I actually heard she's an amazing speaker. So great to have you, Laura. You have the floor.
Well, thank you all. It's wonderful to be here. It's such an honor. I do a lot of work with the United States and with United States and American audiences, and it's a wonderful opportunity to speak to a more global audience about what's happening here in Los Angeles and the threats that we are facing to democracy worldwide. I'll start with a little bit about what we've seen in Los Angeles, and then I'll sort of broaden out to consider how this is not atypical, nor is this surprising given what is happening around the world and Trump's return to power. About a week ago, protests started cropping up in Los Angeles in response to federal agencies that came to Los Angeles and other parts of California to pick up immigrants who are undocumented. The agency is called ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement. ICE has been rounding people up, oftentimes taking groups of people who are immigrants from Central America, Mexico, and other parts of Latin America. Their immigration status, sometimes questionable. And the protests that began in Los Angeles were in response to, and given the public outrage with the Trump administration's pervasive deportation campaign. When Trump was running for office, he promised that he would curb and find a way to deport illegals. The premise here, however, is very difficult. because in order to deport the large numbers that he wants to, he has to circumvent the rule of law and due process rights that everyone has here in the United States. And so when these protests began, many people were angry at what they saw as an abdication, an abandonment of our constitutional and basic rights. This response then from the Trump administration has been incredibly aggressive. He pulled the California National Guard from Gavin Newsom, the governor here in California, saying that the National Guard was essential to provide safety and order. And I want to start with, I think, the first observation, which is this is itself a lie. This is itself a distortion of reality. Because the protests that were happening in Los Angeles were largely peaceful. Even when there was property damage, the presumption being that property is more important than people, that property is more important than dignity and the way that we would protect human rights. That is the premise that the Trump administration is working from. And so a number of arrests occurred, but what had been peaceful protests amped up. They became increasingly aggressive, violent. Journalists were attacked in the days once law enforcement came onto the scene in downtown Los Angeles. And as all of you probably know, if you are following the kinds of movements that are happening now around the world, law enforcement, government, over-militarized response do not make progressive protest movements safer. They actually escalate violence. They create more rancor and division. And the visuals then play into our public fear and further division. At a time when we need solidarity, at a time when we need to really understand what's happening on the ground, in fact, we see journalists getting shot with rubber bullets. We see journalists being tear gassed, journalists being pulled away so that they cannot cover what is happening close to where law enforcement are confronting protesters. This is kind of a playbook. And I want to broaden this out a bit because over the last week now, it hasn't just been Los Angeles. Protests are popping up all over the country here in the United States. We have seen solidarity protests against the immigration raids all over the country. And just 2 days ago, there was a large coordinated movement called the No Kings Rallies. The No Kings Rallies were a response to Trump's over-militarized birthday parade. He brought out military tanks, invited the ranks of military across the different departments to parade for his birthday in Washington, D.C. And as a response to that kind of growing authoritarian presence and his attempt to consolidate power, the public here in the United States has really come together to say, no, not in our name, not the things that we voted for. This is a kind of encroaching authoritarian takeover. It is stripping people of their free speech rights, stripping people of their due process rights. And it creates a climate in which we don't even know how to make sense of what's real. When we don't have people on the ground to cover protests, when protesters themselves are subjected to violence at the hands of law enforcement, when we see that journalism across the country doesn't know how to cover these issues, it creates a kind of blindness for us. And it makes it very difficult for people to have shared sense of reality, an understanding of the facts, and to confront what the ultimate enemy is here, which is the authoritarian takeover. But page one of authoritarianism is to attack media independence, to attack facts. You know, Maria Ressa said so well, if you want to rip the heart out of a democracy, you go after the facts. And that's what we're seeing. This is part of a much longer trend. You know, in the first Trump administration, I was part of groundbreaking litigation in which we brought a lawsuit against Trump and when he was a sitting president. It was a successful lawsuit that challenged his removal of journalists from press briefings. He would pick and choose the questions he liked, and when he didn't like them, he would remove journalists from those press briefings. I look back at that time, in 2018, 2019, it feels almost quaint to consider where we are now. Trump himself has threatened to sue news outlets for their coverage of him and his perceived enemies. He has used agencies all over the federal government to go after the things that he dislikes, the narratives about the election. He has militarized and leveraged agencies like DHS, which is the Homeland Security Agency, to go after protesters. All of this is to create a very specific narrative. And that narrative is essentially one in which free speech is for those who behave and capitulate. And so the protest movement that we are seeing here in the United States, which we are now seeing spread throughout the country, is one of solidarity, one of progress, and to challenge that takeover, the consolidation of power, and the weaponization of a small handful of people. So I'm thrilled to be here today. I'm happy to take questions, but I know that we have two other tremendous speakers, and I'm very eager to hear from them. When we get into the Q&A, I'm happy to answer anything about other aspects of what we're seeing on the ground, the arrests that we are seeing all over the country, the way that journalists are being attacked, and at the end of the day, what this does to our collective sense of selves, our fear, and the kind of fear of retaliation that now many people are weighing. People who are worried that they might have to consider, can I, should I post on social media? Will I then be targeted? These are the types of questions that really only happen when a healthy democracy dies. So, our work at Free Press, the nonprofit that I work at, is to monitor these threats, to work closely with communities, to protect journalists, and to ultimately build a different pathway, a new path in which our freedom is essential. So, I'm eager to connect with all of you. Thank you. I think I'm going to be turning it over to Marcy now.
Yeah, thank you so much. Wow, this was a fantastic start, and really this very bleak topic. And I, you mentioned the No King's March. I just read earlier in the preparation that it might have even been the biggest protest day in all of U.S. history, with like 5 million people all over the country coming together. So I was super impressed by that. I mean, and that shows also how the situation has changed. And interesting, we can maybe talk about numbers a bit later on,
Absolutely.
because that's really, I mean, it's amazing. 5 million people all over the whole country. That's
I
quite.
heard another was 11 million, and I don't know. I'm not sure what the right number is. I've heard a lot of different numbers thrown out there, but we can talk about it later.
Definitely
Thank you,
more,
Max.
definitely more than at Trump's parade, I would say. Can be very certain. I was very certain of that. So on that note, I hand over to Marcy. Marcy Shore is currently a professor of European intellectual history at Yale University, and will begin teaching at the Monk School for Global Affairs at the University of Toronto this fall. Her work focuses on Eastern Europe and the history of totalitarianism. And she just returned from Ukraine, where she worked and co-curated a book. And many of you might know Marcy Shore also for her decision to leave the US after Trump's second election victory, and right, with two others. And it's great to have you here. And I think you're already signing in from Toronto. And we're very eager to hear your view, both connecting what's happening in the US, maybe also with the global, and your view on Eastern Europe. Marcy, great to have you.
Oh, well, thank you, Max. And Nora, I was really grateful for the chance to be able to listen to you. I've been thinking about LA all week, obviously, but I'm not there. I've just been texting with friends who are there saying, okay, what is the mood? What's going on? It's very like, it's hard to feel these things, from afar. My husband flew into Philadelphia for the No King's March this weekend, and he said the atmosphere was fantastic. But again, I wasn't there, so I have only very secondhand knowledge. Maybe I'll start from what you said about how the Trump regime's going after journalists, journalists getting hit by rubber bullets, journalists getting thrown out of the White House. It's very difficult for people to have a shared sense of reality when there's an attack on facts. Maybe I'll say a few words about that, not from the point of view of law, but from the point of view an intellectual historian who works on the history of philosophy, among other things, as it connects to truth, and say that without a distinction between truth and lies, we don't have a basis for a distinction between good and evil. So it really, I mean, Hannah Arendt uses the phrase bodenlosigkeit, this kind of groundlessness. You know, when there's no shared sense of truth, when you lose a connection to empirical reality, you really are losing the ground that you're standing on. And this has clearly been a key strategy, you know, of Trumpism, you know, and also of Putinism. And it was one of the first things that terrified me about Trump when I first noticed him coming on the scene in autumn of 2015, and this complete unhinging from empirical reality that journalists just couldn't keep up with. I mean, journalists are used to fact-checking individual facts. They're not used to a complete disconnect from any connection to empirical reality at all. And I felt like a lot of my, you know, very smart American colleagues were just not taking this seriously enough in the beginning, and just how lethal it could be. And if I panicked sooner than I think most of my American friends and colleagues, it's not because I was any smarter, but because I had been watching what was going on in Russia and Ukraine. You know, and this playing around with post-truth, playing around with there is no such thing as facts, this postmodern twist on, let's call it fascism, authoritarianism, neo-totalitarianism. I was absorbing that as it was playing out in Russia and as Russia was invading Ukraine, you know, already in 2014. And so that caused me to panic sooner about my own country. And maybe with that, I'll just say a word that it's, I'm in kind of a strange position because I'm not, you know, I'm not an American attorney. I'm not a specialist on American politics. I'm American, but I'm not an Americanist. And in many ways, my intellectual life has always been concentrated outside of my own country. You know, I was trained as a historian of Eastern Europe. I work in Slavic languages. You know, for most of my career, I have been focused on really explaining, you know, Europe in general, but mostly Eastern Europe and especially kind of formerly communist Europe and their experiences to Americans. You know, and it's only in recent years, you know, with the collapse of the American Republic, let's call it, that I've been called on then to play the strangely reverse role and explain America to Europeans. You know, and I'm a little bit worried about my competence to play this particular role, but it's a kind of reverse translation because so often I'm the cultural mediator, and especially since the 2022 full-scale invasion of Ukraine, I feel like my main, you know, function in some sense has been doing outreach for Ukraine and trying to explain, you know, to, let's call it, the West, what is happening there. But at the same time, I'm now trying to kind of explain to Europeans what's going on in America. So all those things are a little bit mixed up now. And if I have something to offer, I suppose, it's how I perceive what's happening in my own country through the prism of somebody who spent a lot of time, you know, in the archives reading about the 1930s and the Stalinist purges and fascist takeovers. And so I see certain things that make me nervous because not that I know what will happen, but I certainly know what can happen. And maybe I'll just throw out a couple concepts here. There was a great column, I thought, in the New York Times a few days ago by two Russian oppositionist emigres who said Americans don't have the vocabulary to describe what's happening to them. We're coming from Putin's Russia. We do. We can offer you some words. We can offer you some expressions. There's some overlap, but let me throw out a few others as well. I mean, one of the things I've seen going on both in LA, you know, and as soon as Mahmoud Khalil was taken from the streets. And Mahmoud Khalil was a student at Columbia who had been very actively involved in protest against the war in Gaza. He had a green card. His wife was an American citizen about to give birth. And he was taken off the streets, or taken actually out of his apartment. And Nora would know the details much better than I do, and thrown into a prison in Louisiana. And when the judge in New York said, you can't do that, you have to bring him back, Trump just ignored the courts and they're going to do whatever they're going to do. And that was the first now of a whole series of cases where ICE or guys in balaclavas, or in Russian you would call them siloviki, men of force, could just kind of come and take people in violation of any kind of due process in a largely arbitrary fashion and send them away. And at that time, the Trump administration was claiming that, Mahmoud Khalil was being arrested, he was being deported or planned to be deported to protect Jewish students from anti-Semitism. And I myself am Jewish. I very rarely publicly engaged explicitly as a Jew, but at that time I did sign the petition, not in our name, because it seemed important that Jews in particular step up and say, if we allow what is clearly a disingenuous and cynical, pretext of protecting us from anti-Semitism to be used as an excuse for violating and abusing the rights of other people, we have morally bankrupted ourselves. Like that just on grounds of universal human ethics is not permissible. But the other thing I was thinking, and specifically as a historian of Eastern Europe and somebody who knows something about the history of the Soviet Union and going back into the Russian Empire, was that this is a politics of provocation. And the word provocation in Russian has a little extra oomph in it, provokatsiya. I'm sure Jakob can speak to this very well as well. And it's the idea that the powers that be are, there's going to be a setup. Right? There's going to be a setup in which there's going to be an incitement by somebody pretending to be on a side that they're not, that's going to give an excuse for further acts of violence by the powers that be. And I could already see that, a cynical and disingenuous administration uses the pretext of protecting Jews to violate the rights of other people, and then the justifiable rage of groups of other people whose rights are being violated can then be directed against Jews. And there's nothing that this regime would like more than to play around with that kind of politics of provocation. And that was my first thought in LA as well. I thought, okay, you have protests going on. There's going to be some kind of violence. There's going to be some kind of damage of property, maybe spontaneous, maybe because people were planted. There could always be, this is my, East Europeanist mind, like there could always be people planted in order to commit acts of violence, in order to give an excuse for a crackdown. You're going to violate, your own constitution to then bring in excessive force. Trump calls out the Marines in addition to the National Guard. The Marines have no business being at, a domestic demonstration that should be completely legal in Los Angeles. You're going to provoke acts of violence, which will then be used as an excuse to carry out large-scale violence on the part of the government or to initiate martial law. I mean, that was my intuition, as an East Europeanist, that there's a politics of provocatia going on. So I'll throw out the word provocatia, which is provocation. There's clearly a politics of scapegoating, of purging, which we see in all fascist regimes. We also see in Stalinist regimes. There's always anything that is going wrong in society can be blamed on some group that then has to be violently expelled. And this has been going on since the beginning of time. Stephen Miller is just, I mean, if he weren't for the fact that he's real, he could be a parody of himself with his pathological obsession with deporting people. I mean, this man should clearly be in therapy. He should not be running anything in any kind of the country. The next couple words I'll just introduce quickly. Proizvol. Proizvol is another Russian word that I think we really don't have in English at all. Provokatsiya, you can say provocation, you just need to give it a little oomph. Proizvol literally means arbitrariness, but it's arbitrariness already kind of always already tinged with a kind of tyranny and potentially terror. And it's crucial because it creates a situation in which nobody knows who's going to be next. It's the opposite of the rule of law. You've broken with the rule of law, and now nobody is safe, and you never know what side of the line is safe to stand on. And therefore, everybody is atomized. Everybody retreats. Everyone tries to put their head down and not be next. So the way in which this arbitrariness works, you don't know who ICE is going to come after. You don't know, which student you're going to be sitting in a coffee shop with going over questions for their thesis project when suddenly guys in balaclavas come to take them away. And that not knowing, that capriciousness, that sense that anything could happen at every moment, that atomizes people, and it makes everybody feel scared and everybody feel vulnerable. Maybe I'll just throw out two more things quickly. One of which is prodagnost, salability. The closest in English would be venality. The idea that all relationships are purely transactional and everybody has a price, which is clearly a philosophy that Trump lives by. And Nora just said that the Trump administration works from the premise that property is more important than people. And that's absolutely true, and it carries it. That functions on a variety of levels. When Trump says to Zelensky, you're not holding any cards. And Zelensky says, we're not playing cards. For Trump, everything is a game. Everyone can be bought or sold. And you can do this openly. And it's the openness that is the last point I want to make. There's always been corruption. And prodajnost in Russian, the salability, is a second word for corruption, but it refers less to a specific act and more to a character trait or an existential state in which everyone has a price, everyone can be bought or sold. So there are no more human beings with dignity. And Trump functions on the premise that not only is he living in this world of prodajnost, where all relationships are purely transactional and there are no first principles and there's no such thing as morality, but he does this openly. It is not concealed. It's right there in your face. He has this fancy dinner party for people who brought his cryptocurrency. It's not a secret. It's out there in front of you. And this technique is a strategy that Putin's spin doctors, the political technologists, developed in Russia in the 1990s together with post-truth. The most famous of which was Vladislav Surkov says, our system, as in general, everything of ours, of course, doesn't appear more elegant, but in return, it's more honest. And although not for not everyone, more honest is the same as better, more honest is not without its attractiveness. Our state, he says, is not divided into the deep and the superficial. It forms a whole with everything on the surface. The most brutal structures of its power scaffolding run straight along the facade, not concealed by any kind of architectural excesses. And this is Trump's technique. Everything is right in your face. Nothing is concealed. And the opposition is then disempowered because we look for the thing that's hidden. It's not about what's hidden, it's about what we have normalized. All of the violence and the racism and the sexism and the lawlessness and the arbitrariness and the abuse of power and the ignoring of the courts, it is all right there in the, it's so blatantly that we don't know what to do with it. And I think that normalization is the thing that Americans have to fight against in ourselves. And then Europeans, I think, have to look at what's happening in America with eyes wide open and break out of the denial. Okay, I'll stop there and let Yakov pick up.
Excellent. No, it's perfect. I mean, it's so many super important things, and I think we'll discuss a bit of those in the discussion. Actually, I saw, I think I we'll share it afterwards. You also had an excellent New York Times video with the kind of the two others leaving for Canada, and you also made those kind of points. And that's why I saw those Russian words, and I found this extremely interesting that not having words actually for what's happening there. I think that this is super important. This is also in the European context is extremely important. So, and I want to take that and now give that to Jakub Mamurek. He's a well-known Polish publicist, film expert, essayist who regularly publishes for many newspapers, including Krytyka Polityczna, which we also had some journalists from here also in the webinar. And he's an experienced observer in Polish, European, US politics, and recently has also focused a bit on the role of masculinity in the far right. And actually, we connected last time in a webinar back with Campact, which is one of the biggest NGOs and movements in Germany. And that was actually the weekend before the Trump election, so in November last year. And I think we were speaking, or on the panel that we're actually speaking about, about the success of the Polish elections, where they basically voted out the far right, and basically turning it back, it was stopping the backsliding. Well, and we are here now. A lot of things have happened in the US, a lot of things have happened in Poland. I'm really glad that we have you to kind of open it up and also speak about, successes and failures in the fight against totalitarianism, and how you see it from a Polish perspective. Jakub, so great to have you.
Yes, thank you. Thank you very much for Nora and for Marcy. This was very interesting contributions. And yes, I focus on the Polish perspective, and Polish perspective is interconnected with American, because in Poland, what is happening now in America is very closely observed, because Polish politics is now a kind of, especially Polish right wing, became a kind of a local franchise of the global MAGA movement. After Donald Trump was re-elected as an American president in the last November, the group of Polish MPs, of members of Polish Sejm from Law and Justice Party, starting to chant Donald Trump. This has never happened after the election of any other US president. And also some of politicians of Polish right wing, like member of European Parliament Dominik Tarczyński, actually campaigned for Trump among Polish Americans before the elections. And similarly, during the Polish presidential campaign, Karol Nawrocki, candidate of right-wing populist Law and Justice Party, who has been transforming itself into kind of a local franchise of a Trumpist right of MAGA movement, traveled to the US during campaign. He met with Trump in the White House. And before the second tour of Polish presidential election, Law and Justice Party organized a SIPAK conference in Poland, in Rzeszów, where Kristi Noem, the Homeland Secretary of the US, who also took some part in escalation of situation in the Los Angeles, came to Poland and actually endorsed Nawrocki as a presidential candidate. She called his main opponent a socialist. I don't remember anything happening like that before, when any member of the US cabinet would so openly endorse one candidate and say that the other is a socialist you shouldn't vote for. Nawrocki was also endorsed during that conference by such MAGA figures as Corey Lewandowski, who was also present there, as Jack Posobiec, Matthew Thurmond, and all the other usual suspects of the MAGA movement who were present during that conference. So this so Polish right wing had become a kind of local franchise of global MAGA movement. And a lot of Polish commentators, pundits, were thinking in this connection with Trump wouldn't hurt Polish right, considering Trump's stance on Russia, because Polish society is generally very Russia sceptic. It is we have no pro-Russia, strong pro-Russian party in Poland, and that this politics of Trump, which can be seen as kind of pro-Russian, anti-Ukrainian, wouldn't harm Polish right, but at least so far it did not. We can observe the other thing, that the Polish right is becoming more and more, if not openly anti-Ukrainian, then Ukrainian sceptic and open to this kind of arguments regarding Ukrainian and Russian politics, which Trump is employing in his political practice, which 2 years ago were treated like a complete heresy by Polish right. And when we are observing what is happening in the US right now, we kind of have this feeling that this is what can await us in 2 years, because in 2 years we have another parliamentary election. And when we look at the political scene right now, it all points to the same scenario as in the US back in 2024. Because what has happened in the last 4 or 5 years in the US? In 2020, the Democrats, despite the fact that Trump managed to raise his support to gain more votes than in 2016, the Democrats managed to mobilize a very broad coalition actually win the election, both the general election and both the electoral college. However, after 4 years, a lot of parts of this democratic coalition became disengaged, demobilized, disappointed, disenchanted with Biden administration. And Kamala Harris, who was running as a kind of an heir to the to that 4 years of Biden administration, lost to Trump, who once again managed to gain more votes, both than in 2016 and 2020. And we have the feeling that in 2023 in Poland was a kind of like 2020 in America, in the US, and that we are afraid that 2027 in Poland might be like 2024 in the US. And that the return of law and justice of this populist right-wing party, which is becoming a local MAGA party to power, would be as bad and as worse compared to the first period of the rule of law and justice, to the 8 years from 2015 to 2023, as the second Trump term, which obviously have just started and many things can happen, but it all looks like it is much worse and that it is going to be much, much worse than the first Trump term. In the 4 years of Biden, the US law enforcement, Department of Justice were trying to make Trump accountable for his many things he did when he was a president and during the electoral campaign. These attempts didn't end with success, but they only enraged Trump and some part of his bases. And I think that the similar thing is happening now in Poland, when now we are trying to make politicians of law and justice accountable for the things they did in 2015, 2023, for corruption cases and not only. But all seems that before the next elections, there would be actually no sentences which would put them in jail and would found them guilty in the eyes of the law, in the court of the law. And this attempt to hold them to the account is making the right wing even more populist right wing even more enraged, and setting them on the similar course as we can observe now in the politics of the administration of Trump, which has this view that the state was used, the law enforcement was used to destroy them, and that the whole system must be completely overhauled. And I'm afraid that this is what can happen in Poland if law and justice is going to win the election, especially that if law and justice is going to return to power, it is going to return to power with in the coalition, even more extreme right-wing parties. Because what was very characteristic for these presidential elections in Poland in 2025, in May and June of that year, was not only the fact that the candidate supported by Law and Justice, endorsed by Kristi Noem and other MAGA figures, managed to win, but also a fact that the extreme right-wing candidates right of Karol Nawrocki, together polled more than 20% of the vote. Sławomir Mentzen, who is kind of the ultra-libertarian, mask-like candidate, let's cut all the government expenditures and deregulate the economy, invest in Bitcoin type, got 15% of the vote. And Grzegorz Braun, who is openly anti-Semitic, openly anti-Ukrainian, who claims he is a monarchist, who detests and rejects democracy, got more than 1 million of votes. So we observed this explosion of this support for the right wing. And to finish it, to wrap it up, I was asked also to say about this masculinity as this problem. And it is very, very interesting because two weeks ago, I've made an interview with two experts, one Wojciech Śmieja, who is a professor of men's studies at the University of Silesia and who just published in last year a very interesting book which presented a kind of a cultural history of Polish masculinity in 20th century. And with Andrzej Grzewski, who is a psychotherapist, sex therapist, who works with a lot of men who with patients who come to him with the problems. And they both said that this last elections was a kind of a competition between those who present the most attractive pattern of masculinity. And generally Nawrocki, the guy who won, presented himself as this hyper-masculine candidate. He entered to his first convention to the score from the movie Rocky, about Rocky Balboa, and his campaign regularly emphasized that he's a boxer because he was a competitive boxer as a young man, and now in his 40s he's still practices box. His campaign very often put on the social media videos and photos of him from the gym, like he's running or boxing or doing similar stuff. He was regularly kind of questioning masculinity or manhood of his main opponent, Rafał Trzaskowski, this liberal mayor of Warsaw. Very often the campaign of Nawrocki was posting the thing of the social media, like from the one side you can see Karol Nawrocki boxing, and on the other side of the picture you could see Rafał Trzaskowski marching in a gay pride march in Warsaw with the rainbow flag, and there was this contrast. So I think that this is once again something which Polish right learned from the American right, to tap into some kind of the male resentment and to exploit some kind of a male resentment with the modern world. And Polish right, and Nawrocki and his campaign turned out to be very successful in it. Nawrocki admitted, for example, that as a young man he was a football hooligan participating in illegal fights of the football hooligans, but his campaign managed to turn it into his asset, saying, look, we are living in a very hard time. What kind of a president do we need? Do we need a president who is truly masculine and who is not afraid to fight, also physically, when there is such need? Or do we have a do we want a president who is effeminate? And the public voted for Nawrocki.
Thank you, Jakob. So many. I mean, we could probably go on for a long time. We could definitely fill 2 or 3 hours with that. I want to like pick up where Jakob, where you left, because you basically described what happened in 2023, where basically, you know, there was also a big coalition of very different parties winning the parliamentary election and getting the right wing out, which, you know, I feel like it's a different political situation, but also the Biden coalition in a way, where many people coming together, different movements coming together. And if I stand that correctly, that, you know, last year in the election, that didn't happen anymore. So do you see that? You know, just asking all of you is like, so how important is it to get a big coalition when we want to get rid of the far right? So and we have the two examples here. Do you see the connection there? And then especially also looking at Nora, so what's happening right now? Do you have the feeling that this coalition is rebuilding? Is it getting bigger and bigger with the numbers you said? So maybe Nora first, and then we.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, I think Marcy said something that I think about often, which is the US does not have a language for what is happening. And when I do these types of talks and when I do trainings for protesters and journalists, I think people on the ground are very aware when they challenge rising authoritarianism, what is at stake, you know, that their rights may be violated, that the lawlessness of the Trump administration is creating a violent climate. But many folks do not understand still. And I think it's hard. The level of denialism is very high. When I speak with folks around the United States, many say I'm crazy, or they say it's very depressing. You know, yes, it could happen over there. And over there means whatever. It could mean any, you name it, any place, the Philippines, Hungary, you name it, Poland, but not here. It can't happen here. And that to me is part of what we need to challenge. There is growing solidarity. And I use that word very specifically because I think a lot about how The groups that were targeted in March were those student groups that protested in support of Palestinian rights and freedom and dignity. And now the groups that are being targeted are those that would protest against the dehumanization of Latinos and immigrants from Latin America, Mexico, Central America. I believe if it is you today, it will be me tomorrow. But that premise is a very difficult one for Americans to understand. There is such exceptionalism to every group in America, to feeling like, well, that's over there. And it could actually be over there in another part of the United States. So I believe our task is banding together and making relevant and urgent for people why, if a certain group is targeted tonight, in the morning, they will come for us. And you've seen little bits of this. I'm very excited, actually, by the public consciousness that is waking up. Many people last week saw a sitting senator, Senator Padilla, who was tackled for asking questions in a press briefing of Kristi Noem. He was thrown to the ground, arrested, and put in a holding cell. And many people called me and they said, I'm really depressed, Nora. I'm really sad. I think this is the end. This is fascism. And I said, really? I'm actually so excited that people somehow seem to be waking up. In the United States, somehow more people are now saying, this is not right. And the only caution I have is the continued use of information as warfare and what it does to us. Because in the United States, we have been incredibly victim and vulnerable to disinformation, and it produces a kind of public malaise. And as we feel more politically alienated, we know that that is often a precursor to political violence. We also saw on Saturday the shooting and killing of a sitting senator and a state senator, I'm sorry, in Minnesota. That feels like a really troubling example of the ways people feel there are no solutions and the kind of physical reality manifestation of division. So it's a great question. How do we build together and what do we build for? We have to give people a proactive vision. We cannot just say we are fighting authoritarianism. We cannot say we're fighting something in the negative. We have to invite people in to say there's something better and we all deserve it. We deserve dignity and we deserve freedom. And that's the work that we do. That's the work that I think all of us have to actually challenge ourselves to take on, that we have to step forward even when it is scary. And so that's my final comment here is retaliation is real. I myself am afraid, others are afraid, but we cannot wait for the feeling of hopefulness to come over us because feelings will not come before action. Action has to precede the feeling. And so we have to take actions and we have to take them together.
Thank you. Yeah, I think you wrote in the chat actually that you hear the helicopters outside, and you know that this feeling of to surveillance is so strong as well. And I want to go to the because we don't have much time anymore, so I think we need to repeat this. But so I will take the three top questions here because I think that they cover it very well from the audience. So the first question is, and I think you know that's one that I was also thinking when writing basically the invite is how much does the current development in the USA depend on Trump? Isn't the common denominator of Trump voters only Trump? Without him, wouldn't his movement fell apart into you know isolationist, right-wing nationalist? She says radical Christian. So you know maybe Marcy first, and then also Nora if you would like. So how do you see it? Is it really so? Is it how do we stop Trump? How do we stop Trumpism? And how important is actually he still in everything that's happening? You're muted.
You can't do a control study on real life. So we don't know what would happen if you remove Trump and then Vance comes in. I think it's clear the movement is clearly bigger than Trump. The first moment when I panicked was 2008 when Sarah Palin came on the scene. She, to me, was a character right out of the 1930s. I was thinking, okay, this is, the old right making an alliance with the new right, not yet understanding that the fascists were not just a more energetic version of themselves. She was clear, and I think McCain got scared at a certain point at what he had unleashed. She was living in a totally fictitious reality in which anything was possible, and she would happily incite a mob to lynch someone, and you could feel that from the beginning. So that was clearly latently present. I mean, these things don't happen overnight. It's always step by step by step. Human beings have an extraordinary ability to normalize the abnormal. Americans, for overdetermined reasons, have normalized many things over the years, including a level of everyday gun violence that Europeans would be shocked by and are shocked by when they come in. The kinds of school shootings, we have the highest per capita gun rate, ownership rate anywhere in the world. And so there's a habituation to violence that non-Americans have a hard time understanding. And then you have the situation where the government is brewing this violence. There's an increasing permissiveness towards violence. You see things like political assassinations now, and that is building on what was already a habituation to violence. I completely, agree with Nora that the only antidote to atomization is solidarity. The Poles know this perhaps better than anywhere else. That's why solidarity in Poland was a miracle when it happened. And even if it lasted 30 seconds after communism fell, the fact that it could happen at all, the fact that people could come together that way at all, overcoming all kinds of divisions, was a testimony to the fact that we human beings have that capacity. That was why I was so extraordinarily captivated by the revolution in Ukraine in 2013, 2014. It was that moment of solidarity that happens rarely. It's precious, it's fragile, it's ephemeral, but the fact that it can happen means that we are capable of it.
Yeah, and how powerful that was, I think you also saw from the Russian reaction to it, which was
Yes.
2014. So because it was something extremely dangerous for them, and it is for autocrats if people are coming together. And this is, and I'm taking the second question here, which is was a bit related from Marian. Actually, she asked, isn't the Heritage Foundation network, Project 2025, radical theocratic extremists like Peter Thiel, Chidi Wenz, the greater threat than Trump? And we spoke about this a bit, but maybe you can just quickly say what I found so interesting about this. I think we speak in Europe, we speak a lot about Heritage Foundation Project 2025, Peter Thiel and stuff like that. But how much is kind of the intellectual, pseudo-intellectual underpinning of what they're actually trying, is it how much is it known in the US in those discussions? So is it really so, or is it also part of this kind of ignorance? So, because we won't be able to explain what that all means, but this is just to explain, this is the underpinning of what Trump and Wentz and everyone is doing. So Nora maybe as well.
Yeah, and I know we're short on time. Most of my work focuses now on chaos, coordinated and organic chaos, and what that does to people. And I think that it is nearly impossible to pull the threads and say, well, that was a Peter Thiel move, or pull the threads and say, oh, that was Leonard Leo, or whomever it might be, because these are really interwoven villains, and they are propped up by and encouraged by the kind of normalizing rhetoric we see online. And global leaders will inject authoritarian values into everyday social media posts. Musk is a great example of that. I would say Musk poses one of the most dangerous threats to modern and future life than anyone I've ever seen. And I used to think Peter Thiel was that, but increasingly, I think Musk is perhaps a greater threat. But it's impossible to pull the threads out and say one of these is responsible for various fascist campaigns. What we know is that this is now the 19th year, according to Freedom House, in which global freedom is on the decline. We also know that only 8% of the world's populations live in a full democracy. So what is happening in the US is frankly symptom and part of a much larger global pattern of creeping autocracy. And everyone uses different words in the US because they don't have the language yet. They say autocracy, authoritarianism, fascism, totalitarianism. But what we know is that there are a few people, mostly men and mostly white, who are promoting eugenics-friendly views, dehumanizing people of color and minorities, LGBT, and they are grabbing power and they are keeping power. And they are doing it in part because we are apathetic and we are malaised. And so I think whatever you point to as the root, the effect is ultimately that we are distracted by design. And that is the whole point. So I'll let others speak now. I know we only have a few minutes.
This distraction and this kind of, and I think, I've heard the term muscle velocity as well. So many things happening. I think this becomes an important word now as a strategy. And Steve Bannon was kind of coining that. I think that you have to make
Course.
give the impression that you're in action all the time. You're powerful all the time. You're doing always something else. You're having, very strong kind of muscle contraction, and this is really what also prevents such a movement. As I found it so interesting, because if you have a new topic every day, and as you say, today it's the Latino community in California, and the next day it might be a completely different community that's targeted, and this is super important point. I want to ask, in a couple of in the last 5 minutes, there's a question regarding, the rule of law, the courts, and so on. I want to take Jakob in here, because Tobias asked, and then open to the others. Tobias asked, how do you fight against someone that completely disregards the rule of courts and the due process? How do you keep it legal against someone that disregards legality? So, and I want to put that to Jakob first, because I think one of the main things that pissed it and like the Law and Justice Party of the far right in Poland is actually to erode the rule of law, and there are European Article 7, like Europe calling people know what that means. There are actually rule of law processes and lawsuits against Poland during that time. So that was one of the big feature, I guess, of what they did back in the day. So in your experience, then also looking at 2023, so how did you manage to fight against that as somebody, a government that completely disregarded the rule of law, as Tobias
Well,
said?
it was very difficult, and I think it is going to be even more difficult when we are going to have a new president, because Andrzej Duda was not interested in restoring the rule of law because he was complicit in its destruction. But I think that Karol Nawrocki would move from non-cooperative to openly hostile. Because generally the greatest problem in Poland is that Law and Justice Party practically made the constitutional court dysfunctional. They put the illegally appointed justices there, which made the whole body legally doubtful, and actually there is no constitutional court which would be recognized by all the political actors in Poland now, and there is no way to repair it. And the second problem is that they started to appoint the judges which were nominated by the special council, which was created in the way which was probably contrary to Polish constitution and to European law. And there is a group of judges to status of which there is a huge doubt if they are judges at all or not. And Andrzej Duda refused to sign a law which could kind of rectify that situation and put the end to the doubts about the status of these judges, and start the process of healing. And the ruling coalition in Poland kind of expected that this issue, the same as the issue of the as some other issues like the status of the public television, as the new law which would make the prosecution service independent from political power, could be settled after the change of president. Because in Polish political system is kind of strange one, because it is not presidential like the US. President is not the head of the government, it is prime minister, but it is also not the similar system as in Germany. And president has one very important power: he can veto the acts of the parliament, and to break the president's veto, you need the majority of 60%, and the current coalition don't have that majority, so the veto is binding. And I think that this process of restoring the rule of law simply would be blocked because we won't see the solution for this problem of this judges with doubtful status. We won't see the solution of the problem of the constitutional court.
Thank
And
you.
I
Yeah,
think
I will. Yeah.
but yes, the result of the presidential elections ends the hope is in that area.
And again, I think we see the parallel here, right, Nora? And Marcy, I mean, what, you know, we're talking about the Supreme Court. This is not a new problem. This is a problem from the last Trump administration. So really putting the question also, maybe also as a final question, because we can't really do much more today, but we'll do at a different point. So, you know, what how do you both look? You know, one of you is a lawyer, the other one is coming from a social science philosophical background. So how do you look at the role of the courts right now? So do you still have hope that there will actually, are the courts also fighting back, or is this basically something, you know, you're not expecting? So how do you look at the role of the courts? Nora first, and then we close with Marcy.
Well, I was waiting because I don't have great comments. They're going to be rather bleak.
Well,
So I figured I'd go second. I'm not sure we're really able to end on a
I know.
positive
You know,
note.
well,
No.
so the rule of law, first of all, I love the United States and our rule of law, and I have been incredibly worried for years that what we are seeing is a coordinated and organic attack on freedom and progress. Since 2017, when Trump assumed office the first time, through now, we have seen more than 1,000 anti-freedom pieces of legislation introduced. Many, many of those became law at the state level. That is all throughout the United States, making it harder to pe for people to vote, to criminalize ways that people protest, to limit the kinds of things that we can teach in schools, the books that people can read. I see that, and I see how Biden appointed more judges his first term, his only term, than Trump did during his first term. So we are in a stronger position in many ways now than we were when Trump left office. So I always try to at least buttress my worrisome, bleak comments with the idea that many of the strong, durable tenets of the rule of law still exist. That being said, I look at examples worldwide, and I'm curious what Marcy will say as well. In the Philippines, more lawyers have been killed than journalists. And I think that is a sign of the times, that one of the ways you go after justice and the rule of law is to gut an entire flank of defensive players. Lawyers are the line for when everyone else feels there has been an injustice, because we bring the cases and judges then hear those cases. I am aware of individuals from the federal government now sitting in district court level proceedings and hearings, waiting and just hearing what's happening. That is deeply troubling. They have access to private and sensitive information in those cases. They are possibly creating a kind of additional layer of retaliation for judges who may have to now think about what the reaction will be based on their own upholding of the rule of law. So I'm very worried, and that doesn't mean that we are hopeless, but it means that these are areas of society central to healthy democracies that are incredibly vulnerable right now to a set of actors who have endless money and endless, boundless power that they are seeking. And in trying to find the weak points, they have gone after journalists, gone after activists, and now going after law firms. And so I think it really is a slow erosion that we will watch over the next 3.5 years in the United States, that we have to again remind ourselves what courage means. Lawyers have to stand up and judges have to stand up for the rule of law. That is not a partisan issue. That is a democratic, basic, neutral tenet for any modern society to function well. Thank you. And I want to give the closing word to Marcy, and actually maybe quickly on the topic of the rule of law, but also I think here's a very important question from Bärbel Winkler here. She asked, what can Germans, what can Europeans do meaningfully to support democracy and democratic movements in the US and elsewhere? So also, the question of, how can we support, how can practical solidarity look like? Not that everything is great in Europe, but I think, solidarity goes both ways. I'll see.
Okay. Well, first of all, I would say that among the things that have been catastrophic has been the bankruptcy of the Supreme Court, especially as it was stacked, with various Trump-appointed justices. I think things started falling apart already with the 2010 Citizens United ruling, which essentially created a platform in which American elections could be bought by people throwing lots of money at them. Now we've had the overturning of Roe v. Wade, and that the Supreme Court ruling on presidential immunity last summer, which of all the disastrous things that happened last summer, I thought was the worst because it created a situation in which Trump was not going to be held accountable for anything, including inciting a violent insurrection on the Capitol and encouraging a mob to hang his vice president. Now, the lower courts have been fighting back. It's not that all of the justices, have gotten in line, and from the beginning, Jesse Furman was saying, you must bring back Mahmoud Khalil. People, you must bring back Garcia. You must. And the Trump administration is saying, go to hell. We're not going to. And so we're in now this sui generis situation where lots of courts are doing what they're supposed to do, and the executive branch is refusing to recognize them against the Constitution. And then there's a question of, is somebody going to use violence? Because the administration is saying we don't care about the law. Maybe the last thing I'll say is that, as as an American who has been to a bunch of protests in America and also been to a bunch of protests in Poland when I happened to be there, even though I'm not Polish, like I was at the Women's Day March back in 2017 with my two little kids in New York, and that you just felt like there was such an enormous number of people on the streets. You thought, okay, this can't happen in America because there are so many people who understand what's going on and are protesting against it. And I've had that same feeling in Warsaw, being at massive demonstrations against PiS's attempts to undermine an independent judiciary. And Poland is very similar to the States in the sense that you've got a population more or less divided down the middle. And so all of those, big swings and whether or not democracy survives, it comes down to a really small margin of potentially swing votes. I remember there being a big headline in Gazeta Wyborcza the day after these massive demonstrations in Warsaw, that I happened to be in Warsaw then, so I was there with my kids, and the headline was "Jeszcze Polska nie zginęła," Poland is not yet lost, and that, and there's so many people that you thought it has to be it, like they have to win, like the good guys and the bad guys have to be done for now. But no, you still have that little margin that, is keeping the right-wing populist in power. And that Nawrocki won by a hair's breadth. And that's the way Trump won this election too. You're talking about a very, very
Yes.
small margin of voters. And that's both the source of hope and a vulnerability.
Thank you. Yes, and actually, I think I got a bit of goosebumps when Jakub started to talk about Poland and how closely this is related. And now you also did it, but I think it really gives me hope that, because I think when it comes to the question of Babel, as what really matters is to spread the news, to talk about it, also, to also, for example, in European sense, also to pressure the European Commission and the European governments to be strong against Trump. We already see that, for example, we've spoken about information war a bit, right? And about social media. So Trump and Musk and all the others are actively pressuring the European Union not to enforce the digital rules, not to curb disinformation, not to curb hate speech, right? But to continue with basically leaving Zuckerberg and Musk and everyone a free hand. So, and I think when it comes to what can Europeans do, it's really also use what we have as a power, and the power is the European Union, European Union laws, and the kind of the idea of coming together in Europe and being a really really strong actor that, if strong and if powerful, then also can stand up to an autocrat like Trump, for example. And that really, I think that for me is also what we can do actively in Europe as an example to really push for those kind of things that we have a very strong European response against what Trump is doing, especially on the, I think, on the information front. So that is all we have time for. It was really, I mean, it's amazing. It was bleak, but I think it was super important. Also, the connection. I thank you all for taking the time. The probably over 2,000 people that joined us over the hour, like our three guests, our two interpreters that had to deal with a lot of fast speakers. So thank you all. Thank you all for your attention. We'll be back at Europe Calling on that topic and many other topics, and probably meet you all again very soon. Be safe. Take care of yourself and your family. And I hope to see you all soon and in our next Europe Calling. So have a nice evening or day, or well, we have so many time zones now, it's impossible to say. Have a good time. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.